accession number 28353, reel 10.
Peter, the previous tape ended with you, with me suggesting this was a debilitating routine, but you were happy with any 4 hours sleep
well,
a night.
Providing I'm doing it regularly, then I can survive on that sort of amount of sleep without, I think, getting overtly worn out. Certainly, one would be tired from time to time, but I can recharge the batteries relatively quickly. That's not to say that if somebody says you can stay in bed for 8 hours, that I won't gratefully accept it and actually sleep for 8 hours, but I can also operate to a routine of 4 or 5 hours without great trouble, or I certainly could. And so I think the Sasso Strike Command, combined with the other hats that I held, as I say, made this probably the most toughest job in terms of just sheer volume of work to be done. Because as the Gulf sort of went away and we had started to recover all the forces, we then of course had Saddam exerting pressure on the Kurds again, all the Kurds rushing up into the hills on the northern Iraq, southern Turkey border, and the major government then declaring that we'd got to go to the support of the Kurds, rightly in my view, and we then got into Operation Haven, which was initially just the resupply of those people and then the looking after them and so forth. And the joint headquarters for that operation was vested in High Wycombe, with the commander-in-chief of the day being the four-star commander and me being his director of operations. So we went straight from one to the other, and no sooner had sort of Operation Haven finished, but we started to get into the no-fly zones of North and South Iraq, and therefore the deployment of aircraft back into Turkey to look after the northern no-fly zone, flying from Incirlik, and into Kuwait and Saudi Arabia for the mounting of the southern no-fly zone, and those operations again run from High Wycombe, with the commander-in-chief being the four-star commander.
So the RAF were operational in both?
Yes.
No-fly zones?
Yes, they were.
They were?
Yes. Yeah, we had had aircraft flying over the north, tankers and offensive and tactical reconnaissance aircraft, normally Jaguar supported by tankers in the north, and Tornadoes operating, air defence Tornadoes operating out of Saudi Arabia, offensive Tornadoes operating out of Kuwait over southern Iraq, with tanker support normally operating out of Bahrain.
And broadly, what was the ratio of US to RAF?
Oh, I suspect we were probably only something in the order of 10 to 12% or so of the total forces deployed, something of that order, 10, 15%, that sort of range.
And there has been a suggestion in the press that that this, after a while, these no-fly zones became quite a hot war area with quite a lot of attacks being delivered against the Iraqis.
They did eventually, yes.
But not at this early stage?
Not at this early stage, no. Some, from time to time, in response to threats from the Iraqi, mainly ground-to-air systems rather than air-to-air systems, because Saddam had lost most of his air force, his flying air force, during the first Iraq war. But certainly he got a very extensive surface-to-air missile organization, which he kept redeploying and threatening, and we had rules of engagement that if threatened we could release weapons. Then every now and again, more subsequently than now, then we would launch perhaps a 3 or 4 day extensive campaign against certain key targets and then go back to a more steady state patrolling, but with still rules of engagement which allowed to attack if threatened by him. In terms of effectiveness, it's very difficult, I think, to say. I mean, there's little doubt in my mind that it stopped him persecuting the Kurds in the north and also stopped him persecuting the Shias in the south. But equally, he maintained and rebuilt a tremendous amount of his defence infrastructure whilst we were doing it. So, I mean,
did he?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I mean, all his communications he rebuilt and so forth. He probably didn't rebuild his surface-to-air missiles, but he developed them further, he modified them, brought new technologies, homegrown technologies, into Russian-built surface-to-air missile systems to make them more effective against us, and quite ingenious in some ways, quite ingenious. So it wasn't a risk-free business for the crews flying over those no-fly zones, not a risk-free business at all. A lot of people got shot at.
But nobody was hit or not?
No, Royal Air Force aircraft was hit, and we didn't, we touch wood, during the no-fly zone period, we didn't lose any over Iraq to technical reasons. That is also quite surprising. We had a Jaguar which had to force land at Deir Bakir one day, and therefore fortunately got out of Iraqi airspace. But we didn't lose any, which was, again, very fortunate. Very fortunate. Whilst, obviously, these operations, first of all, the wind-up from Desert Storm, then Op Haven, which was the Kurds in the southern Turkey, then the no-fly zones, clearly there was the implementation now of the policy decisions taken in London as a result of options for change to implement, so quite a lot of work across the command to manage the redeployment of assets out of Germany to close Larbrook and Gütersloh to bring the forces back from there, to move the Royal Air Force Regiment from its base at Catterick into Honington, which was now freed up because the tornadoes are gone. So a lot of detailed implementation of the policy decisions taken by MOD. Quite a lot of NATO reorganisation going on, as again NATO started to come to terms with the end of the Cold War and how should it reorganise itself to be, or could continue to be, effective in a changed world within Europe. So we saw, you know, the formation of a new major subordinate command in AF Northwest, which amalgamated United Kingdom Air Forces, for which I was the director of operations, with Allied Forces Northern Europe, based in Oslo. So it brought Norway and Great Britain together into a combined NATO command area, as opposed to being two individual ones. And as the director of operations for UK Air, I was heavily involved going up to Norway fairly frequently to decide how best the two previous major subordinate commands could be brought together into a coherent single NATO command. And part of our problem there, which took a lot of detailed thought and so forth, was the degree to which, for example, maritime air would be involved in that, because previously the air envelope over those two commands had quite a big gap between them, where, for example, the American striking fleet, their carrier fleet, could sail and operate within its own bubble of airspace. Now we were going to have a contiguous air envelope covering both areas into which the striking fleet might come, and integrating their assets into this contiguous airspace grouping was going to be really quite difficult. So a lot of discussion as to how we were going to integrate maritime based air operations into this airspace, which was largely two land blocks, Norway and ourselves, with a lot of water in between. That said, I had an international staff working for me with my NATO hat on, 50% of which were UK officers, but 50% of which came from Germany, Norway, Denmark, etc., America, and a one-star head of that team, an American, who I have to say, because of the load in the other two areas, the senior air staff officer and the director of operations for national operations, my one-star American deputy in NATO matters did take quite a lot of the load of NATO matters, and increasingly so over my time. there, for which I was very grateful, and a very competent American he was. I mean, unless I'd had someone like him running it, I think it might have broken the camel's back. But he was a great assistance indeed. I think the other things that were going on were, again, the process of greater devolvement. I spoke about the new management strategy of Heseltine's era when I was the PSO at Strike Command. Now we were into the detailed implementation of that and the devolvement of budgets to a command secretary at their command headquarters, working on behalf of the commander-in-chief, but with accounting officer responsibility for that money, and therefore much greater focus and devolvement from the top-level budget, as the command was, of something over £1 billion a year, down to stations where station commanders might have budgets of, say, £50 million a year. Not that any of us had total freedom over those budgets. I suppose at every level, the sort of freedom that you really had once you'd taken away the cost of manpower, over which you really didn't have a great deal of control on a year-to-year basis, the cost of fuel and so forth, you probably ended up with the ability to veer and haul something like 10% of it. Whether you were a station commander, that might be £5 million. If you were a commander-in-chief, it might be £100 million. So useful flexibility, but not as much as one might sense if you're told, well, you've got a budget of £1 billion, because it wasn't. Towards the end of my time at Strike Command, we reformed something called 38 Group. And which was the Air Transport Force, took it out of one group where it had been lodged for a while and formed 38 Group again, probably to recognise the growing importance of air transport again, now in an era which was starting to show us that expeditionary operations were more important. But in order to do it without raising the headcount, Sasso Strike was invited to be AOC 38 Group as well. So I picked up another hat of being a group commander of 38 Group. I only held the job for about 3 months, but nevertheless it was an interesting period, and clearly I spent quite a lot of time getting to know the Air Transport Force, because it wasn't a force that I had really any great experience of, other than being a passenger from time to time. So I made a point of going out and flying with all the different forces, whether it was the VC-10 force, the TriStar force, the Hercules force, converted certainly to the Hercules so that I could actually fly the aeroplane down route and things of that nature. Learned to fly the 32 squadron assets, the HS-125s, which we used for getting around UK from A to B, which meant that, you know, whenever I flew somewhere, I could sit in the left-hand seat and fly the aeroplane.
What is an HS-125?
Looks like it's a Dominie, sort of an executive jet, seats about 6 or 7 people in the cabin, has 2 little engines at the back on the fuselage, and a typical sort of executive jet, of which at that stage we had 11 or 12 or so. It's been whittled down over time. We've now got about 6 or 7 of them, I think, maximum. But a very useful asset for flying from Northolt, just outside London, up to Lossiemouth or something of that nature, a journey you can therefore do 20 minutes out to Northolt from central London, 50 minutes in the air, and so an hour and 10 minutes you're up in northern Scotland on the ground. So a very useful way of getting from A to B. So taking on this other hat of 38 Group was for, again, about my last 3 months at High Wycombe. I'd done 2 years virtually to the day at that stage, and was then posted to command one group at Royal Air Force Upavon with effect March of 93. I should mention, I suppose, at this stage, my last Christmas, the Christmas of 92-93, I rushed off to New Zealand, where my father had settled. some 10 or 11 years earlier, in the sort of the aftermath of my mother dying, he married again and married a New Zealand lady and settled in New Zealand. He was now sort of 81 or so and seriously ill, so I flew out to New Zealand over Christmas of that year, and he died as I flew home, sort of just after Christmas. Clearly again a family hiatus, but I think at that stage, from his perspective, he had now seen me get on really quite well in the Air Force. I think my mother had always had visions of me making 2-star rank, but never lived to see it. I think she always had that in the back of her mind. I think because in their day, the senior commanders were something of a rarefied atmosphere, and I think as a wing commander or something, you didn't often see 4-star officers in the Air Force, and therefore probably the highest rank level that you tended to bump into on anything like a regular basis was probably 2-star level. And so I think she had got it into her mind that that if I was going to make it at all, I needed to get to 2-star level, and that's where she had pitched her horizon for me. I have no idea where my father had pitched his horizon for me, but he had seen me now get to 2-star, so I suspect that he probably thought that there was a chance that I would go a bit further, because he would have understood that I was young in rank and things of that nature. So I was either going to step on my foot and shoot myself badly, or else I was going to go on to make a reasonable fist of this career that we had shared. Is that a good point to?
Yes, it is. I'm just going to ask two questions. One relating directly to what you've been talking about. This is the second time that you've mentioned what your parental aspirations for you might be. Did you ever have that in your mind at any time, either in the back or even in the forefront? But you have mentioned it twice.
Yes, only because I think, it was quite close to my parents. My mother, I know, was quite ambitious for me. I think my father was just keen that I did as well as I could. But I think my mother was quite ambitious, and had she lived to be a right old lady, I'm not sure I should say this, but I think she might have been insufferable as mother of. But there you go. She would have been undoubtedly very proud. But I think she did have aspirations. But I think from my own perspective, it has just always been, and I'm not afraid to say so, a quiet determination. I hope a sense of ambition, if that's the right word, which isn't overt, which doesn't climb on others to get where I want to go. And I think if you were to go and ask people, they would not gainsay that. I would rather, if there is a conflict of that, I would rather step back and let other people judge rather than say me, if you know what I mean. But a quiet determination always to do as well as I possibly can, because I'm never satisfied with anything less than the best in myself. I will accept things which are less than the best I know other people can do far more readily than I'll ever accept it from myself. I think I have always been that way, but the person, again, who really taught me to be is that chap John Thompson. Mm. I mean, you do a piece of work for him, and it would go up to him, and he'd have you up, and you could see that he'd written all over it. All over it he would have written, and yet he would never let you leave the office thinking that you hadn't done a really good piece of work. you knew, you know, from the questions that he asked, that you hadn't thought of all the angles and things of that nature. But you would always leave thinking that you'd done a good job for him, because he would never let you leave the office without doing so. And that was one of his great, great strengths, because he had the capacity to make up for any inadequacies in it. So nothing ever went out of his office which wasn't extremely good. But if your work wasn't quite up to what he thought it would be, he wouldn't tell you, but he would just change it, and you'd see that he'd made lots of alterations, and off it would go. We sat opposite each other in an aeroplane one day going to Northern Ireland for a day, where he was speaking at a dinner given by the Lord Mayor of Belfast. And we were going across in one of these 125 aeroplanes, and he said, were you involved in writing the speech for tonight? And I said, no one approached me, although it was my station at Aldergrove and things of that nature, it's a subsequent job. And so he threw me what he was being told to say and said, what do you think of this then? So I read it through fairly quickly, and I said, I think it's a bit, you know, it's a bit nitty-gritty and detailed, you know, it's not big enough. You need to be looking at, you know, the role of Northern Ireland, the role of industry in Northern Ireland and things of that nature, and you, having a Northern Ireland background, will be able to do that wonderfully well. You don't need to get into the niff-naff and trivia that this is really focused. He said, you're right, he said. So he started writing in the aeroplane, and his writing was hopeless. Desperately difficult to read. Really difficult to read. Just like a doctor's. And he spent the next 35 minutes writing frantically. When we got to the other end, we were going to the station commander's house to change and then go out to dinner. He said to me, I'm not going to stop until I've got 5-10 minutes more work to do. I'm going to do it upstairs, and then I'll come down and I'll be sociable and things of that nature. So off he went. 10 minutes later, he was back down again. We went to this dinner in the sort of council chambers in Belfast. He stood up to speak, and I had read what he said. If there was one word common to what was given to him, to what he said, it was the word "the," somewhere sort of in paragraph one. He had just totally rewritten it. But he would go back and he'd have said thank you to the people who wrote it for him.
Perhaps your most important role model?
Yes, without a shadow of doubt. And somebody, I think, in the service, there's no doubt that you make your own luck, of course you do, and create your own impression that other people take away and so forth. But there's also a degree of patronage goes on, always has done, I suspect, and I think still does. And I've no doubt that I have been guilty of it as well. You take a shine to somebody who really, you know, you would choose in your team on any day of the week, and there's no doubt that you tend to drag them along with you because they're like thinking people and so forth. And there's no doubt that Peter Harding was one who dragged me along a bit, but John Thompson was actually more influential because I actually had more respect for him than I did for anybody else, but also because I think he felt that he and I worked together well as a team. And in the one or two subsequent moves later on, where he was directly involved in putting me in the right place, not least because he thought and knew he was going to be the Chief of Air Staff at a particular time, and he wanted me as his deputy, so he manoeuvred it, although he wasn't chief at the time, he manoeuvred it such that I got the assistant chief's job and would be there for perhaps a year or so before he got there, but that again we would work together as a team.
My last point then before we finish this afternoon is I'm interested that you mentioned Peter Harding as a, if you like, a supporter to your principal role model and teacher in a way. And you haven't mentioned, and I was expecting you to from what you said earlier, you haven't mentioned David Craig.
Oh, well, if I didn't, that's a mistake, because I enjoyed working for David Craig, and there are many things about him that I admired. No, I think the only reason that I referred to Peter Harding was not as a role model, because I wouldn't want to model myself on him as a senior commander. I thought he was brilliant in some ways, but I wouldn't want to model myself on him. But what I did say was that I think that he took something of a shine to me, and therefore, for example, my early elevation to 2-star when he was CAS, to go from the director job in MOD to being Sasso Strike, was because he had said, right, you know, I'm moving this chap. And I think there was perhaps a degree of patronage there.
Yes.
But no, as a role model and things of that nature, I think I would draw more from Lord Craig than I would from Peter Harding.
Right. Well, thank you.
But at that stage, just to develop that, the gulf was, if you like, too big still at that stage. I mean, when I was working for...
The gulf in your respective positions.
Yes. While I was working for Lord Craig, you know, the gap was still really quite substantial. I was a wing commander, just group captain.
And he was an Air Chief Marshal.
He was an Air Chief Marshal, going on to be CAS and things of that nature. Whereas John Thompson and I, he would have been, you know, perhaps 5 years old, 5 or 6 years older than me, and 1 or 2 ranks ahead of me. So it was much, much more of a relative
No, I understand.
Relationship.
Well, that's maybe a good opportunity, a good opportune moment, I should say, for us to draw stumps this afternoon.
I think it probably is.
And we'll fix up a time and recommence again in the new year.
Yeah, would that be all right to wait down until the new year?
That sounds fine.